So as I mentioned at the beginning of Mass, our Lenten walk really begins in earnest in certain respects today because we enter today into the Sunday, the opening one of the season. And while Ash Wednesday was the opener a couple days ago, the Sundays really drive the shape of Lent, drive the prayers, drive the themes, drive the understandings and the concepts. And the readings are rich and beautiful in their reflections, and many of their selections on the certain Sundays of Lent go back many, many centuries. So today we really kind of launch. And per custom, today's launch is the temptation story of the Lord Jesus in the desert. And we get it these days, since the council from different angles every year. So Matthew 1 year, Mark another year, and Luke this year as they go through the three-year cycle. But always the same story, the temptation, or perhaps a better translation or word is the testing of the Son of Man, his testing. To understand a little bit why the church opens with this gospel every single year for Lent, and there's a whole lot of reasons, obviously, but just to give one kind of dimension to it, it's worth backing up a second to consider a much, much older story about a wilderness situation than the one we heard just a moment ago in Luke's beautiful gospel. The older story goes way back to the book of Exodus, to the journey of the Israelites once upon a time. We don't know much about it historically. All of our sources of the situation come from the scriptures themselves, almost all of them anyway. But I think we can safely say this much by way of a summary that helps us understand and frame it for this morning's reflection. We know that the Israelites were given the promised land, and at a certain point in time, due to famine or due to their own particular challenges, they left the promised land and went into Egypt, out of their home. And while they were there, as time passed, it became a place not anymore of freedom, but of slavery, of difficulty, of hardship, and of a life that they had to get out of. They were not happy or in a good space in Egypt. We know that God, through his servant Moses, comes to rescue them, that he hears them, he's aware of their plight, and he brings them back out, back to the promised land, back to their home. And it's a journey that's going to take them 40 years. That's a long, long time. And it takes them through a wilderness. And they're going to look back on that story as time would pass and recognize certain key things about this journey from Egypt back home in the desert. They recognize there was a time of real failures on their part. A lot of complaining. It's all over the Bible story about complaining about this, complaining about that. A lot of failures, a lot of mistakes, a lot of letdowns, so to speak. So it was a walk of a realization of their own frailty as a people. But also, they realize that in this time of testing, their own kind of temptations and failures in the desert, they learned a new face of God, a deeper face of God, that through all of their mess-ups, he was profoundly faithful. So the wilderness journey back home for them, for the Israelites, a time of testing and failure, they're aware of that, of their own testing and failures, and profoundly aware of God's mercy, his steadfastness, his fidelity, the fact that he was with them all the way through and all along the way missed not one beat. That experience shaped them as a people. They needed to go through it to help them understand things about themselves and about God that they've kept with them even to this very day as God's chosen. That's one journey. Now fast forward to this gospel we just heard. It's another wilderness story. Back in the desert, 40 days this time, not 40 years, but intentionally the same quantity in terms of 40 anyway. It draws us the fact that the Son of Man in the story is reliving that ancient story. He's now doing it himself. But this time, in his testing, in his tempting, like Israel was tested, he's not going to fail. He's going to hang on, and he's going to trust in his Father's providence, his protection. And the story is meant to kind of bring up to the surface, you know, what the Son of Man is made out of. Who is this guy? That's how Luke opens his gospel, and Mark 2 and Matthew as well. And we find out in this story, this man is faithful. He's faithful where we fail. So he's going to kind of relive this wilderness experience in Exodus. He'll be tested, and he's going to show forth again the fidelity of God, that God is steadfast, that God is not deterred by our own wayward wanderings, that a new twist of history, God comes among us as one of us to stand in our place and be faithful. We were not faithful. So deep is his commitment to us. And the temptations that the devil throws at him all center around this idea of faith. Can I trust my Father or not? Is my Father going to rescue me or not? Can I do this mission ahead of me or not? It's Israel all over again. Well, this time Jesus says, yes, I can trust him. And I do trust him, and I will. So back to the opener for Lent, why this story? The church wants us, among a whole bunch of other things, okay, to see the Lenten season every year as a wilderness walk. It's a wilderness walk. It's, on one level, the Old Testament ancient Exodus wilderness walk of 40 years, and it's also this 40-day walk with the Son of Man. Each of them desert experiences. And the church wants us to understand that as one goes through Lent, what the season is designed to do is test us, like being in the wilderness. And we're tested, so to speak, to raise up our frailties so that we can learn that we are weak, that we are sinful, that we can have this experience of a journey, of a trek through the wilderness, becoming mindful of all the ways that we mess up, just like the Israelites did, but also, just like the Israelites and also in the gospel, we also learn along the way God's mercy, his patience, his generosity, his bedrock absolute fidelity, faithful, faithful, faithful. So the Lenten walk, it's a wilderness walk to raise up those two dynamics, our failures and frailties and God's steadfast fidelity to catch us as we fall. Not only that, okay, the church has always seen Lent as a mini version, a microcosm, to use the fancy word, of life itself. Life for the Christian, life for man, for fallen man, frankly, is the same wilderness walk. Life's a big, long wilderness walk, okay, full of testing and challenges and trials and desert experiences, and all through life, same thing. We learn our frailties and also hopefully that God is with us. So in ritual form, long story short, every single year the church says to us, you must relive this Lenten wilderness experience to teach you that it's just a smaller version of your whole life. So you know how to handle it, who you are, and who you're frankly not, you're not God, and that God is God, that he loves you, and he wants to walk with you every step of the way, and he is with you. That's why Lent opens, among other reasons, but that's the big one for this morning, with this wonderful story. So we're walking it. We're here in the story. Today, Lent, and life itself. Now, part two, really quick. If life is this walk, one might unpack just a smidge for a few moments the particular temptations that come at us in life, the testing that is often very much a part of who we are. And there's a whole myriad of them, right? And we won't list them all this morning. It would take a long, long time. And there's temptations about things like food and about, you know, what we see on TV or about, you know, sexual ethics and everything else. Those are important things that are not to be made light of. But for this morning, I think I would land on just kind of three deeper temptations, which all come down to the question of faith, of faith itself. And they are sort of, mistaken notions that the devil sometimes puts in our heads to throw us off the track in our wilderness walk. One temptation goes kind of like this. It is this idea in my head or your head at times that God's love for me only depends upon my behavior. That he's only going to love me if I'm perfect, if I don't fail. So I get through life, right, and I'm a mom or I'm a dad, and I realize that my kids didn't turn out quite like I thought they were going to. Surprise. And I have this, like, crisis of I'm this awful, bad, terrible parent. They're going to put me on the cover of Bad Parent Magazine. You know, here I am, right? And I think I'm useless. You know, it's true for pastors, too, right? We have a little crisis of identity, okay? No matter what it is in life, parenting, pastoring, in a job, as a student, as a disciple, period, we all mess up. And I think when it happens to us in that moment, that desert moment, our first thought is, oh, wait, I'm a piece of garbage or something like that. And God's only going to like me if I follow his commandments. Like my worth depends upon what I do. It's a very common trap, right? So that's a temptation. It's a temptation to doubt God's love for me because I'm so aware of my mistakes at times. What do I do with that? Now, the reality is actually the reverse, and it's hard to grasp this sometimes because we're so programmed the other way, but the fact is God's love for us does not depend at all upon our behavior. He loves us no matter what. Precisely because he loves us, he has high expectations for us. He wants great things for us. He holds the bar super high, but it's not like he runs away when we don't meet it. He does the reverse. He rushes to our assistance when we fall because he wants to get us up, up, up so fast. So because God loves me so much, regardless of my behavior, I strive to love him back, and I don't despair when I realize that I've fallen short. He loves me anyway. Because he loves me, he wants great things for me. And he weeps when I mess up. To put out a shocking thing to say this morning in the world stage, but it is biblically, theologically accurate, God loves you and me as much as he loves Vladimir Putin. That is an absolute fact. Precisely because he loves Mr. Putin so much, he's horrified, I dare say, at what he's doing right now. He's disappointed profoundly, but he doesn't love him any less. Because he loves him, he calls him right now to something better than he's doing. Me too. Because he loves me and you, he calls us all the time to better than we are. He loves us, though, no matter what. His love is constant. So in life, I think, we fend off at times the temptation to think, I'm not a lovable person because I've messed up. Not true. A second temptation would go kind of like this. It is the idea that when bad things happen to us or to the world, personally, globally, that God is punishing us, that God doesn't like us anymore. We hear this all the time, you know, when things happen to me, to my friend, to my neighbor, to you, to the Ukrainians, to whoever, you pick the victimized group and they're all around us, we think to ourselves, you know, a loving God wouldn't allow this. He must not be paying attention. Isn't he noticing? Why does this hardship come into me or to my friend or to my family member? Would a loving God allow this at all? Surely God knows what's going on. He's choosing not to stop it. Therefore, he doesn't love me, doesn't care, and the suffering I'm experiencing or somebody else's must mean that I cannot believe in a loving, provident God. No, God must be some sort of a tyrant, right? This is the crisis of faith of the modern world and, frankly, of all of human history. Read the Psalms. How often do they cry out to heaven saying, "Where are you?" So in life, the poignancy of what's hard for us or for the culture or those around us shakes our faith. That's what's going on in the gospel story, right? The devil's trying to say to Jesus, do you really think your father's going to help you? Why don't you cheat a little bit? Why don't you let yourself slide? Why don't you rest in some falsehood instead? This is what's going on in the contemporary battle for faith in the world. We question if God cares sometimes at all. The biblical answer, contrary, over and over again, is this. God knows exactly what's going on. He knows exactly what he is doing. He misses nothing. And as the gospel story and that Exodus journey shows, he allows the tests that we go through as persons and as a world to bring us to a deeper knowledge of him and of ourselves. The suffering comes because he loves us. There's no other way sometimes to learn that we are loved. So the leap of faith, the stretch of the heart of faith, is to understand that it's not that God's not paying attention. On the contrary, the testing of life is what he wants for us so we can grow in our faith and love of him and of ourselves in the proper sense. So no despairing when things don't go well. This is the thing. The world right now, as messy as it is, God has not abandoned the world, nor has he abandoned us. Never, ever, ever. And our walk of life shows us that if we pay attention. And last temptation, it's related very closely to the one prior to it, but just to kind of rephrase it a bit, it is a temptation to think that God doesn't have a plan, that this isn't going somewhere. Or to rephrase it a smidge, maybe it's a temptation to think that as something changes, it's all over with. In life, we must be led down new pathways as a world, as a culture, as persons, as families, as parish communities. I mean, so something comes along that's not what we're used to. The norm is shaken. And our first reaction is to say, wait a minute, the plan's off. Like, I thought I knew the plan, and now we're off the plan. Where is God? So my temptation is to think God must not have a plan here. He's not going to win evil is going to triumph. Sin is going to overcome. Temptation, temptation, temptation. Contrary to that, what does the Bible say to us over and over again if one reads it even remotely carefully? God always has a plan. He's firmly in charge. And when things look the worst, frankly, they usually are working towards something far, far better. We just have to ride it out until it comes. So the world right now, writ large, like I said, messy place. But don't think for a minute that God's done with the world. He's not using our conflicts to help us or to push us to a deeper knowledge of himself. No, he's using it to move us into a deeper sense of faith, a deeper sense of urgency against evil and sin. It's all part of what he wants to do. Anyway, the point is, okay, life is a wilderness walk in different ways, shapes, or forms for all of us. And it feels more like a desert other times than others, but we all get to the desert point along the way. And the church says in Lent, pray your way through the reality that all of your frailties and your questions of faith and your doubts about me, God says, at the end of the day, don't add up to any reason not to believe. God says, I'm always with you. And if it seems hard in the world or hard in your heart, just know I'm allowing it only for a time to bring to the surface what you're really made out of. To bring to the surface me, God says. And whatever doesn't belong, whatever isn't in me, we're going to cast it out, get rid of it, heal it away, forgive it away, work it away. But you're not going to have it rise to the level of your heart or the world unless you are first driven through the test. That's what wilderness journeys are for, as Exodus and the Gospel show over and over again. So let's make Lent a little version of life, the idea, and learn through it our own frailties, but above all and more deeply God's beautiful, profound faithfulness, steadfastness, and graciousness to all of us who are his children.